Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I'm your host, Sandy Fowler, and before we get started, quick reminder to head over to mightyparenting.com to get your free email series on communicating with your teen, as well as to see all the other support that we have for you there. And today we are talking about depression. And the CDC tells us that mental and behavioral disorders are increasing in our kids. And I know many, many families who have dealt with or are dealing with these issues. You all know, if you've been listening for a while, that Judy's son Jeffrey suffered from depression, addiction, and suicide ideation. My daughter deals with depression and anxiety. When I'm out in my community, I regularly talk to other parents who have someone in their family, often their teens and young adults, whose lives are impacted by depression, anxiety, or other issues. And I know that for me personally, when I first saw signs that there was something happening with my daughter, it didn't fully register. And even when it did, I had no idea what to do about it. And when that happens, we tend to kind of push things away if we don't feel like there is a clear avenue of action. We can tend to like not let ourselves see something. And that's why I want to talk openly about these concerns on Mighty Parenting. Emotional, mental, and behavior issues are so very common, and we want them to be commonly discussed so that families aren't blindsided. And that's what today's guest does. And part of that is because she felt blindsided when her husband died by suicide. She didn't know the warning signs or what to do when you think something might be wrong. And she wanted to prevent other people from experiencing the grief she went through. Her name is Christy Hugstad, and she is the author of Beneath the Surface, A Teen's Guide to Reaching Out When You or Your Friend Are in Crisis. So Christy, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. My pleasure.
I also want to thank you, Christy, for sharing your experience so candidly. It is certainly not easy to publicly share grief and regrets, but you have taken this moment in your life to do just that and to teach the rest of us what we need to know to keep our loved ones safe. And it is so, so very much appreciated.
Well, you know, after my husband's suicide, I just thought, you know, I've got a couple different options here. I can either be a victim of my grief and my depression and just try to struggle to get out of bed every day, or I can use my pain to help other people so that they don't have to go through what I am going through. So it was kind of a no-brainer. I just decided, you know what, use your pain to help other people. So that's been my mission ever since the day that my husband died.
Well, you've done a beautiful job with the book. I so enjoyed reading that. And you open the book by talking about what's happening in our teens' brains. And I just think that's so helpful. You know, parents spend a lot of time going, what were they thinking? Why would they do that? So to kind of kick off our conversation, you know, get us in the frame of mind of understanding the people we are trying to help most and the people that we care about, would you share with us what is happening in our teens' brains?
Well, absolutely. And I think this is a big missing piece of the puzzle when parents try to understand their teens. Why exactly what you said? What were you thinking? And what it's so important for teens and parents to understand is that very front part of your brain, that prefrontal cortex, that part of your brain isn't developed. And it won't develop till about the age of 25, maybe a little earlier in girls, but 25 is a safe number. And what that means is their ability to make good decisions is not there, and the impulse control isn't there. So that's why it's important for parents to understand that sometimes you need to act as your child's prefrontal cortex, because that's not how their brain is wired. And if you think back to when you were that age, I know for me, I can't believe some of the things that I used to do, like driving without seat belts and driving 90 miles an hour. And it never occurred to me, if I do that, what are the consequences? What are the possibilities that could happen? You act on impulse, and then later you might think, wow, you know, that wasn't too smart. So I think it's important for the parent and the teen to understand the brain development and why teens are more likely to act on impulse. And that is another factor in suicide and depression. If they are more likely to act on impulse, they're not going to make good choices. So if they're experiencing depression, they may turn to substance abuse, to drugs and alcohol as a coping mechanism.
Yeah, and we hear about the prefrontal cortex. What I loved is you also explained how the brain actually does develop, starting with, you know, the instincts and moving forward from there. And when I read that, it just made it, I don't know, for whatever reason, it clarified for me that our kids aren't being arrogant or egotistical or stupid. They're acting on instinct and in some of those other more, I guess you could say, more basic types of thoughts and things. And the little bit of a concern that I have is that as parents, we'll get scared and go, oh my gosh, they can't make any decisions. I'm going to make all the decisions for them. And that leads to more of the helicoptering or snow plowing or whatever you want to call it, but basically being over involved in their decision processes. So how would you recommend that we balance that idea of giving them room to grow and to learn? Because if we don't ever give them a chance to exercise that prefrontal cortex, that still won't develop and grow, right? I mean, we have to have them trying to use it. So do you have ideas on how we can kind of balance that a little bit?
Well, there's a real happy medium between taking over your child's life and being there to kind of serve as someone who's listening and encouraging and guiding and supporting and teaching, right? So those five things are the major role of the parent, and that doesn't mean control and, you know, and take over. So you have to make sure that you are there to support and guide and teach without making them feel like you're suffocating them and taking over. And that's why, too, when you think about their peers, when you're a teenager or a young adult, all that matters is what your peers think about you and what's going on in your little world, which is at school. And so if you are not capable of making really rational decisions, you're going to be more easily influenced by your peers. Meaning if your peers are drinking or smoking pot, whatever, then you probably are going to be more tempted to do that because your first concern is fitting in and being accepted.
And that's a function of their brain. It's not, I mean, there are other things that support that. And there are things that we can do. We can, we've talked about some of the things on the show, like encouraging them to explore their interests and to grow in those areas, because that helps to help them identify who they really are, who they want to be, help build their self-esteem, all those things. And they're still going to be fighting that basic brain structure.
Well, exactly. But it helps if we're all on the same page and we understand that teen brain. So you are prepared and you know what to expect, and you are able to navigate with your child to help them through those developing years.
So the brains are more susceptible to many things, you know, peer pressure and things. Also, they're more susceptible to depression. So how common is it for teens to experience depression?
Well, I think most teens at some point in their development experience different degrees of depression. And like I said earlier, you know, their little world is very small. And when they're not fitting in or they're on social media and they're not getting the likes on Snapchat or Instagram, it makes them not feel good about themselves, and it's their self-esteem is constantly lowering. So social media and technology is a big part of developing self-confidence. And when they're not getting the likes and they're not feeling good about themselves, they start to fall into a depression. And once they're in that depressive state, they turn to other things to self-medicate. Maybe alcohol will help. Maybe if I change my friends and I start hanging out with this group of friends at school that drink and take drugs, that will help numb the pain of that depression. They don't know how to navigate through the depression, so they're going to turn to other things like cutting, self-harm, substance abuse, development of eating disorders. So the parents, it's so important that you recognize the change in your child's behavior, because it's a really tough time to be a teen.
I love the way you said that, is that they don't know how to navigate through the depression, because that is a piece that we as parents can impact. And we'll talk about some different ways that we can do that, both before or after the fact. I also wanted to just mention the idea that I know the idea of hearing about depression can scare a lot of parents. And I want them to understand that this isn't a horrible, scary thing. And there are also two kinds of depression. You know, there's situational depression, which is just that. It's around a situation. And as you move through that situation, if you learn healthy coping strategies, you just move beyond it. But even people who deal with depression on an ongoing basis, as you said, they can learn to navigate it. It's just getting another tool set. Like, you know, we navigate having diabetes, or we navigate being susceptible to bronchitis. My co-founder of Mighty Parenting, Judy Davis, that woman is so susceptible to bronchitis, but she's learned tools and strategies for managing that over the years. We do the same thing for depression. So let's talk about that just a little bit more, Christy. Like, what is depression really?
Well, it's more than that feeling of sadness, because all of your kids are going to be sad. You're going to be sad. We're human. That's an emotion that we all experience. But when that darkness doesn't lift for a couple weeks or longer, and you are feeling that heaviness and darkness, even when things are going right, and that dark cloud doesn't seem to lift, those are signs that your child or you are falling into a major depression. And that's why the warning signs are so important, that you catch it early, because the longer that goes on, the harder it is for you to be able to reel it all back and get your child to a really healthy place. So, you know, think of the depression in your child as your child in time, become somebody that you no longer recognize. That's, I think, the easiest way to explain it. You know, their friends are changing, they're withdrawn, they start to isolate. You know, they're not coming out of their room. There's changes in behavior. Social relationships are changing. They're skipping school. Their grades are declining. So look for those signs. And don't just brush it off as normal teen behavior. Sometimes it is, but if this has been going on for a considerable amount of time, you need to get your child help.
And you mentioned something in there. You said if you or your teen, it's not just teens who are suffering from depression, it's also parents. And so, one, I want parents who are listening to go, wow, is this me or my spouse who might be dealing with this? And I also want us to go, you know what? This is an opportunity. This is an opportunity to show our kids what we can do to navigate this. We can model healthy coping strategies. We can model getting help. We can model discussing this openly with our kids and with our spouse, and making this the normal thing that it is, because it is very normal as far as occurrence goes.
Absolutely. And there is a genetic component to depression. And I think parents need to know that. Look at your family history, because those are risk factors for your kids. And if you or your husband or your aunt or your uncle or your sister, if there is a genetic component to the depression, there is a possibility that you could have passed that to your child. And they are watching you. And if you are displaying signs of depression, you need to realize that you are a role model for your kid. And if when your child comes home from school and you're laying on the couch and you can't get up and interact, you have to also watch your own behavior.
Yeah, this is true. And living with someone who's dealing with depression can create more stress for our kids. It can impact their emotional wellness just from living with someone with it, aside from any genetic components or anything else as well, because it's challenging. It's challenging to be the person dealing with it, feeling it, experiencing it. But those who live with you also deal with it, feel it, and experience in their own ways just by being in the same household with you.
Yes, and sometimes kids will take their adult's depression and their behavior that goes with it, and they will own that to the point where they think, this is my fault. What am I doing to make my mom so unhappy? So, teens want to please their parents and they don't want to be a burden. So if they're in an environment that has depression and behaviors that are very negative, your kids are picking up on that. And the really sad part about that is a lot of those kids will own it and take it on that it is their fault. So you have to really be careful of that as well. And they're probably not going to say, mom, is it me that's making you sad? Is it me that's making you not want to talk? They're not probably going to call you out on that.
Right. And depression can look like sadness. It can also come out as anger. And that can be really tricky.
Yes, absolutely. Anger sometimes is depression turned inward. So that is often mistaken for just, teenage angst, and it's actually teenage depression.
So whether it's us or our kids, what are some things that we can do to navigate through depression?
Well, I think the most important thing is you have to understand what exactly is depression. You have to know the signs, because there has to be an intervention and you need to get help. Right. So when it's reached the point where it is major depression, your child or you need professional help. How can you help somebody when you don't know they have depression, when you don't know the warning signs and the risk factors? And I will speak of that personally, because I knew that my husband was not mentally healthy, and every warning sign of depression was right there, a red flag waving in my face. And he died by suicide. So I can't stress enough how important it is to understand the warning signs and risk factors of depression so that you recognize them early and you can talk to your child, keep those lines of communication open, start conversations, and get them the help that they need.
Yeah, Judy and I had talked about that before. Her son, Jeffrey, attempted suicide when he was in college. And as a long story short, one of the things that came out of that was the two of them wrote a book for parents. It's Warning Signs, and essentially helping parents to understand, depression, addiction, suicide ideation. What does this look like? What are the warning signs? What can you do? Similar to being the flip side of your book, yours is directly specifically written to teens. Ours was directly to parents. Well, she and Jeffrey wrote it and they gave it to me and said, hey, would you read this and see if it makes sense to anybody besides us? And in reading it is when I had kind of my blinders taken off going, oh, wow. Okay. So these are the things that are going on with my daughter, and there is something I can do about it. What can I do? Where can I go? What are some options for getting help? And so I was able to start those conversations. And when she was in a place where she really needed help and she was ready to do that, we're able to intervene, like you said, early, so that it didn't take all that long. She did take a year off college, but she took that year, she worked on things, she worked with a professional, she found new emotional, healthy coping strategies, and is doing just fine, as opposed to Jeffrey's journey, which lasted many, many, many years, where he suffered through so much pain and anxiety and multiple suicide attempts that nobody knew about. So that speaking up, opening that conversation, helping your kid, offering to get them professional help, encouraging them to go get that help, and to just be having those conversations is so critically important. And, you know, Judy's family and mine are proof in the pudding that it does help. It does work. Not to say that a parent's responsible for their child getting well, because only the child can do that. But we are responsible for making options available to them and encouraging them.
Yes. And I think it's also important for parents to realize that, you know, okay, you make up your mind, you're going to open the lines of communication. You're going to have that talk about depression and the different behaviors that you've noticed in your child. So the first thing that you need to do is make sure that you have their undivided attention, you know, that they're being held hostage in your car when you're driving 20 minutes.
Cars are the perfect, we've said, I don't know how many times, it's also the place where kids tend to open up.
Yes.
It's a great place to have a conversation.
Right, because they're held hostage. And I think that's important.
And they don't have to look at you. They don't have to make eye contact. There's something about that environment that makes many kids feel more comfortable.
Yes, you're right. They're not looking eye to eye with you. They can kind of open up at their own pace. Or another good time would be when they're in bed and you're sitting at the end of the bed. And again, they're held hostage. But what you have to understand is you may not always get the result that you're setting out for. So just because the timing is convenient for you, it may not be for them. And you may get those one word answers again, like, okay, Jason, you know, I really want to talk about some of the changes in your behavior that I've noticed. You seem really quiet. You're isolating. You know, are you okay? Is there anything that you need to talk about? And the response may be, I'm fine. You know, so it's hard for parents, because just because it's convenient for you does not mean it's the ideal time for them to open up. So that's when you need to say, hey, I just want you to know how much I love you. I care about you. I'm here for you whenever you're ready to talk. So keep those lines of communication open so that your child will feel comfortable coming to you when they're ready. And your timing and their timing may not be the same.
That is so important, Christy. I love that you brought that up and talked about that. It's not that you need them, even if you are pretty sure that there's really an issue, you don't need them in that moment to agree with you. Or like you said, get that outcome of you're expecting that, oh, well, we're going to have a conversation. They're going to say, okay, fine. And we're going to go get some consulting, some therapy, some counseling, some whatever. The idea that that's not necessarily the outcome in that moment, but to keep being there and just keep being there is such a beautiful idea. And it also reminded me that long before we even might think that there's a problem, just start talking to our kids and going, hey, you know, I was listening to Mighty Parenting and they were talking about how so many kids are dealing with depression or anxiety and other issues. If you felt like that, who could you go to? And that act of having them think through and name somebody, a responsible human being, whether it's a school counselor or a parent or a grandparent or a friend of the family, any adult that they felt they could go to, having that name said and already thought through is a big help too. So if they get to that point, I always tell my kids, I'm like, I hope you feel you, whatever it is. You know, we always used to joke when they were younger. Well, if you got to call somebody from jail, I hope you feel you can call us. But if you can't, who would you call? Right. And we put the humor in there, but it made them think it through and they know, oh, okay, Uncle Chris, because he'd bail us out and never tell you about it, you know? Right. But they have that adult they can go to. And with what you said with your strategy, we are also making ourselves an adult who's a viable option for them to come to.
And the main thing that I stress when I go to schools and I talk about all these different issues that they may be dealing with is that if I'm speaking to you, if these warning signs and risk factors or if any of these issues apply to you, tell an adult you trust. And it may not be your parent. As a matter of fact, I remember after one conversation I had with a group of ninth graders, I was that adult that they trusted because I wasn't their parent. I wasn't their teacher or their principal. So they felt that they could trust me. I was just somebody that cared. And there was a line out the door because I was safe. So you have to understand that sometimes your children will not come to you because they don't want to disappoint you or they think that you'll pass judgment. They don't want to tell their teacher because they feel there may be consequences. So yes, you may not be that adult that they trust, and that's okay. And you as a parent need to be okay with that as well.
Yeah, I remember the day my daughter kind of got forced into talking to me about her panic attacks. And at one point, and I say conversation, it was really me just being quiet and letting her talk. But she stopped and she looked at me and she said, "You're not freaking out." And I think that's something else. It's not exactly the disappointment or the judgment, but they don't want to deal with our response because they know we love them and this is going to impact us. And so just that fear of whatever response it is, the freaking out, the judgment, the whatever, can stop them. So yeah, I love that you offer to be there for kids. And you're right. You're a safe choice. You are not a school, you're not school personnel who's going to have to call their parents and tell them you aren't the parent, but yet somebody who cares. And we can also tell our kids about the talk and text lines that they can reach out to. I don't know, Christy, if those are things that, you know, that you've had any experience or know kids who've had experience with personally, but I will put these in the show notes as well so that everybody has them. But it's 1-800-273-TALK is a phone number that people can call if they're in emotional distress. Or you can text to 741-741. And they can text any word, hi, help, start, go, anything. And there are trained individuals on the other end who will kind of first aid them through the process and go, okay, where are they at? Are they safe? What do they need? And then guide them to a step to help. And again, that's that place that is not mom and dad, not someplace that, or not an adult that we're concerned about consequences with. And we still want to do everything we can as mom and dad to make ourselves an adult they feel they can come to.
Well, and I think for parents too, it's so important that you don't buy into the stigma of any kind of mental illness. If you think that your child has depression, you need to, number one, be very direct in the way that you speak to them, especially with boys. Don't dance around the issue and try to make it more comfortable for yourself. You have to be comfortable talking about these issues so that you are showing your child that you are not a part of the stigma. And there is nothing wrong with having depression. It's an illness, and there is treatment, and there is hope. So as a parent, you need to check yourself first and make sure that you are not buying into the stigma. Because if you're uncomfortable talking about it, your child will be too.
Yes. Amazing point. And again, a reason to just throw out this interview around the dinner table and just start having conversations about it. And you're not going to do it every day or once a week. You're going to do it just at various times when either it occurs to you or maybe feels natural, or if it's not natural, go ahead, put a note for yourself in your calendar. But you said something else there too, Christy. You made the point. There is help. There is hope. Depression and all these other issues can be treated. And what I'm saying by other issues is we obviously can't go into all of it today, but you talked through so many different things: eating disorders, bullying, self-harm, PTSD, peer pressure and stress, anxiety, substance abuse, technology addiction, and suicide. And the thing that all of those have in common is that there is treatment for all of them. And that is a huge piece of it. And I keep saying that because I remember when Judy and Jeffrey and I, we went to an at-risk high school and we're giving a talk there on depression, addiction, suicide prevention. And that was what I saw when the kids were asking questions, is they just didn't know that treatment worked and that there's hope. They just kept pounding Jeffrey with those questions, like, really? Treatment actually helps? Like, I don't have to feel this way. So I think that's really important that you share this message with us and with us and with our kids, that yeah, there are things you can do. And you also talk about in the book, Christy, you talk about things that we can do preventative as well. Because depression happens, sometimes it's a chemical thing that is, you know, genetic, and sometimes it happens because of the changes in our body chemistry with the situation. So we can impact those and we can help prevent those and keep ourselves healthier. What are some of the things that we can do to navigate and create emotional wellness?
Well, I think the first step is to realize that when you have depression and you're struggling, the dopamine level, that feel-good chemical in your brain, is lowered, right? And I also work with addicts in recovery, and it's a real struggle to get the addicts who have been using and are now clean to realize that their brain chemistry has changed and their dopamine levels are low. So you have to find ways to raise them naturally. And that means you cannot stay in bed all day. You've got to get up. And the most important thing is you've got to move. Because when you start exercising and you get out, you get some sunlight and some vitamin D, you get some fresh air, you start to move, you eat healthy. All of these things start to change your brain chemistry. And that is what's causing your depression. You know, obviously there's situations that are contributing to it, but the physical things that you can do will start to alter your brain chemistry. The endorphins are raised when you exercise and you move. So you have to practice self-care. You can't just isolate in your room and lay in bed and hope that it goes away. If you and that's why I wrote Beneath the Surface, because we need to teach the adults and our kids all of these different tactics, and it needs to start early, right? So our kids grow up having normal conversations about what they're going through, and our mental health should be talked about as openly as our physical health. If you, let's say your child had cancer, you wouldn't say, well, why don't you go lay in bed and hang out in your room until it passes, right?
Right.
You immediately would get them to a medical professional to get the treatment that's right for your child. And the same protocol needs to happen when our youth and our teens have a mental disorder. We need not to wait until it passes and ignore it and pretend it's not there. We need to talk about it openly and honestly so the stigma is no longer there, so people will feel comfortable reaching out and getting help. And that's what's going to save lives.
So true. And we don't have time to go into all the other topics. In the book, you did a chapter on each of those different things that I named, the eating disorders, bullying, self-harm, and you talked about how each of those situations can contribute to depression, or depression can contribute to the situations, kind of that little circle. I think the book is a beautiful thing to give our kids, like each kid their own copy to keep in their room so they can look it up. I remember when my girls were little, I think it was one of the American Girl, you know, your body and you type of things. And then when they were older, you know, got them something more age appropriate just to be learning about themselves, their body, those changes that are happening. I kind of see your book the same way. Like, hey, these are things that can happen to us mentally and emotionally. This is normal. It's not something we want to live with, but I shouldn't say normal. It's common. And people deal with it. And there are things we can do to deal with it. And to let them have access to that information is so great. So would you please share with our listeners where they can get a copy of your book, besides, of course, in our show notes. We always have links in there.
It's available in bookstores nationwide. You can go to Amazon, you can go to Barnes & Noble, Target, Walmart, your local bookstores. So it's available anywhere books are sold across the country. It's also on my website at thegriefgirl.com. And that's another place that you can find my book.
Okay. And so just a few quick highlights from our conversation today is, you know, as parents, we need to remember that our teens' brains are still developing, that they don't have that prefrontal cortex, which is what we use to make well thought out good decisions. They are functioning much more on the more basic and instinctual parts of their brain. And so they are more likely to be impulsive, to do things they can't see the consequences of their decisions. They're also more susceptible to depression. And then as they start feeling those feelings, they can be looking for ways to deal with it and become easily influenced by peers into using unhealthy coping strategies like drinking, drugs, self-harm, and things like that. So we need to make sure that we're talking to our kids, that they understand what depression is, and that this is common and there is treatment for it, and that it is more than just feeling sad. Feeling sad is also, it's normal, it's good, it's a feeling that will pass. We just need to experience and let it go. But if that sadness is lasting, you said more than a couple of weeks, or we're feeling that sadness even when our life is going right, then it's time to reach out and get some professional help, because obviously whatever coping strategies we're using are just not working for us. So it's time to get some professional help and learn some other ways to manage this. As parents, if we are possibly dealing with a depression, we need to model good behavior and take care of that. Not only for ourselves, but also for our kids, because they can see us and blame themselves for our behavior. They can end up owning it and taking it on as their fault. And we want to make sure that we're keeping the lines of communication open with our teens so they know they can come to us, but also be offering them the option of going to see someone else, having that conversation of saying, hey, if you felt in emotional distress, who could you go talk to? And let them think about it and maybe come back to you later, but have them name an adult who they would feel reasonably comfortable going to, someone they think they could go to. Christy, I love our conversation and I appreciate what you have done here for teens and the parents too.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. And again, one last thing that I want to just throw out there is the most common thing that I get from parents is, I don't know how to start the conversation. You know, we're always talking about those three simple words, start the conversation. So the most important thing I think of my book as a resource is in the back, I give you questions for each issue that I talk about. So that is a tool to actually help you have that conversation with your child.
Oh, great. All right. Well, we'll have you pick one or two of those to put in the show notes. And then, of course, the rest are still available in the book. And Mighty Parents, thank you for being here today, for joining us and being part of the Mighty Parenting community. Appreciate you. Appreciate when you rate, comment, and share the podcast. It really helps us get out and reach more parents. So thanks so much for doing that on whatever podcast player you listen to or on our show pages. If you want to add comments at the end of the blog post, we appreciate that too. Remember, you are a mighty parent. You've got this, and we'll see you next week.